like my new mother to have it. My darling child! My darling child! Mother would be glad. But it's my party. I have a present for my dear daughter. But I'll have to do it in my own way. Now, Kate, you open the bottle of wine and pour two glasses while I cut the cake. I want it to be fancy. When everything was ready, Faye took her seat behind the table. She raised her glass. To my new daughter, may you have long life and happiness. And when they had drunk, Kate proposed, to my mother. Faye said, you'll make me cry. Don't make me cry. Over on the bureau, dear, bring the little mahogany box. There, that's the one. Now put it on the table here and open it. In the polished box lay a rolled white paper tied with a red ribbon. What in the world is it? Kate asked. It's my gift to you. Open it. Kate very carefully untied the red ribbon and unrolled the tube. It was written elegantly with shaded letters, and it was well and carefully drawn and witnessed by the cook. All my worldly goods, without exception, to Kate Albee, because I regard her as my daughter. It was simple, direct, and legally irreproachable. Kate read it three times, looked back at the date, studied the cook's signature. Faye watched her, and her lips were parted in expectation. When Kate's lips moved reading, Faye's lips moved. Kate rolled the paper and tied the ribbon around it, and put it in the box and closed the lid. She sat in her chair. Faye said at last, are you pleased? Kate's eyes seemed to peer into and beyond Faye's eyes, to penetrate the brain behind the eyes. Kate said quietly, I'm trying to hold on, Mother. I didn't know anyone could be so good. I'm afraid if I say anything too quickly or come too close to you, I'll break to pieces. It was more dramatic than Faye had anticipated, quiet and electric. Faye said, it's a funny present, isn't it? Funny? No, it isn't funny. I mean, a will is a strange present. But it means more than that. Now you are my real daughter, I can tell you. We have cash and securities in excess of $60,000. In my desk are notations of accounts and safe deposit boxes. I sold the place in Sacramento for a very good price. Why are you so silent, child? Is something bothering you? A will sounds like death. That's thrown a pall. But everyone should make a will. I know, Mother. Kate smiled ruefully. A thought crossed my mind. I thought of all your kin coming in angrily to break such a will as this. You can't do this. My poor little girl, is that what's bothering you? I have no folks. As far as I know, I have no kin. And if I did have some, who would know? Do you think you're the only one with secrets? Do you think I use the name I was born with? Kate looked long and levelly at Faye. Kate, she cried. Kate, it's a party. Don't be sad. Don't be frozen. Kate got up, gently pulled the table aside, and sat down on the floor. She put her cheek on Faye's knee. Her slender fingers traced a gold thread on the skirt through its intricate leaf pattern. And Faye stroked Kate's cheek and hair and touched her strange ears. Shyly, Faye's fingers explored to the borders of the scar. I think I've never been so happy before, said Kate. My darling, you make me happy too. Happier than I have ever been. Now I don't feel alone. Now I feel safe. Kate picked delicately at the gold thread with her fingernails. They sat in the warmth for a long time before Faye stirred. Kate, she said, we're forgetting. It's a party. We've forgotten the wine. Pour it, child. We'll have a little celebration. Kate said uneasily, Do we need it, Mother? It's good. Why not? I like to take on a little load. It lets the poison out. Don't you like champagne, Kate? Well, I've never drunk much. It's not good for me. Nonsense. Pour it, darling. Kate got up from the floor and filled the glasses. Faye said, Now drink it down. I'm watching you. You're not going to let an old woman get silly by herself. You're not an old woman, Mother. Don't talk. Drink it. I won't touch mine until yours is empty. She held her glass until Kate had emptied hers, then gulped it. Good. That's good, she said. Fill them up. Now come on, dear, down the rat hole. After two or three, the bad things go away. Kate's chemistry screamed against the wine. She remembered, and she was afraid. Faye said, Now let me see the bottom, child. There, you see how good it is? Fill up again. The transition came to Kate almost immediately after the second glass. Her fear evaporated. Her fear of anything disappeared. This was what she had been afraid of, and now it was too late. The wine had forced a passage through all the carefully built barriers and defenses and deceptions, and she didn't care. The thing she had learned to cover and control was lost. Her voice became chill and her mouth was thin. Her wide-set eyes slitted and grew watchful and sardonic. "Now you drink, Mother, while I watch," she said. "There's a dear. I bet you can't drink two without stopping." "Don't bet me, Kate. You'd lose. I can drink six without stopping. Let me see you." "If I do, will you?" "Of course." The contest started, and a puddle of wine spread out over the tabletop, and the wine went down in the magnum. Faye giggled. "When I was a girl, I could tell you stories maybe you wouldn't believe." Kate said, "I could tell stories nobody would believe." "You? Don't be silly. You're a child." Kate laughed. "You never saw such a child. This is a child, yes, a child." She laughed with a thin, penetrating shriek. The sound got through the wine that was muffling Faye. She centered her eyes on Kate. "You look strange," she said. "I guess it's the lamplight. You look different." "I am different. Call me Mother, dear. Mother, dear. Kate, we're going to have such a good life." "You bet we are. You don't even know. You don't know. I've always wanted to go to Europe. We could get on a ship and have nice clothes, dresses from Paris." "Maybe we'll do that, but not now." "Why not, Kate? I have plenty of money." "We'll have plenty more." Faye spoke pleadingly. "Why don't we go now? We could sell the house. With the business we've got, we could get maybe $10,000 for it."
"No."
"What do you mean, no? It's my house. I can sell it." "Did you forget I'm your daughter?" "I don't like your tone, Kate. What's the matter with you? Is there any more wine?" "Sure, there's a little. Look at it through the bottle. Here, drink it out of the bottle. That's right, Mother. Spill it down your neck. Get it in under your corset, Mother, against your fat stomach."
Faye wailed.
"Kate, don't be mean. We were feeling so nice. What do you want to go and spoil it for?"
Kate wrenched the bottle from her hand. "Here, give me that." She tipped it up and drained it and dropped it on the floor. Her face was sharp and her eyes glinted. The lips of her little mouth were parted to show her small, sharp teeth, and the canines were longer and more pointed than the others. She laughed softly.
"Mother, dear Mother, I'm going to show you how to run a whorehouse. We'll fix the gray slugs that come in here and dump their nasty little loads for a dollar. We'll give them pleasure, Mother dear."
Faye said sharply,
"Kate, you're drunk. I don't know what you're talking about."
You don't, Mother dear? Do you want me to tell you? I want you to be sweet. I want you to be like you were. Well, it's too late. I didn't want to drink the wine, but you, you nasty fat worm, you made me. I'm your dear, sweet daughter, don't you remember? Well, I remember how surprised you were that I had regulars. Do you think I'll give them up? Do you think they give me a mean little dollar in quarters? No, they give me $10, and the price is going up all the time. They can't go to anybody else. Nobody else is any good for them. Fay wept like a child.
Kate, she said, don't talk like that. You're not like that. You're not like that.
Dear mother, sweet fat mother, take down the pants of one of my regulars. Look at the heel marks on the groin. Very pretty. And the little cuts that bleed for a long time. Oh, mother dear, I've got the sweetest set of razors all in a case. And so sharp. So sharp. Fay struggled to get out of her chair. Kate pushed her back. And do you know, mother dear, that's the way this whole house is going to be. The price will be $20, and we'll make the bastards take a bath. We'll catch the blood on white silk handkerchiefs, mother dear. Blood from the little knotted whips. In her chair, Fay began to scream hoarsely. Kate was on her instantly, with a hard hand cupped over her mouth. Don't make a noise. There's a good darling. Get snot all over your daughter's hand, but no noise. Tentatively, she took her hand away and wiped it on Fay's skirt. Fay whispered, I want you out of the house. I want you out. I run a good house without nastiness. I want you out. I can't go, Mother. I can't leave you alone, poor dear. Her voice chilled. Now I'm sick of you. Sick of you. She took a wine glass from the table, went to the bureau, and poured paregoric until the glass was half full. Here, Mother, drink it. It will be good for you.
I don't want to.
There's a good dear. Drink it. She coaxed the fluid into Fay. Now one more swallow. Just one more. Fay mumbled thickly for a while, and then she relaxed in her chair and slept, snoring thickly. Dread began to gather in the corners of Kate's mind, and out of dread came panic. She remembered the other time, and a nausea swept through her. She gripped her hands together, and the panic grew. She lighted a candle from the lamp and went unsteadily down the dark hall to the kitchen. She poured dry mustard in a glass, stirred water into it until it was partly fluid, and drank it. She held on to the edge of the sink while the paste went burning down. She retched and strained again and again. At the end of it, her heart was pounding and she was weak, but the wine was overcome and her mind was clear. She went over the evening in her mind, moving from scene to scene like a sniffing animal. She bathed her face and washed out the sink and put the mustard back on the shelf. Then she went back to Fay's room. The dawn was coming, lighting up the back of Fremont's Peak so that it stood black against the sky. Fay was still snoring in her chair. Kate watched her for a few moments and then she fixed Fay's bed. Kate dragged and strained and lifted the dead weight of the sleeping woman. On the bed, Kate undressed Fay and washed her face and put her clothes away. The day was coming fast. Kate sat beside the bed and watched the relaxed face, the mouth open, lips blowing in and out. Fay made a restless movement, and her dry lips slobbered a few thick words and sighed off to a snore again. Kate's eyes became alert. She opened the top bureau drawer and examined the bottles which constituted the medicine chest of the house. Paregoric, painkiller, Lydia Pinkham, iron wine tonic, Hall's cream salve, Epsom salts, castor oil, ammonia. She carried the ammonia bottle to the bed, saturated a handkerchief, and, standing well away, held the cloth over Faye's nose and mouth. The strangling, shocking fumes went in, and Faye came snorting and fighting out of her black web. Her eyes were wide and terrified. Kate said, "It's all right, Mother, it's all right. You had a nightmare. You had a bad dream."
"Yes, a dream."
And then sleep overcame her again, and she fell back and began to snore. But the shock of the ammonia had lifted her up nearer consciousness, and she was more restless. Kate put the bottle back in its drawer. She straightened the table, mopped up the spilled wine, and carried the glasses to the kitchen. The house was dusky with dawn light creeping in around the edges of the blinds. The cook stirred in his lean-to behind the kitchen, groping for his clothes and putting on his clodhopper shoes. Kate moved quietly. She drank two glasses of water and filled the glass again and carried it back to Faye's room and closed the door. She lifted Faye's right eyelid, and the eye looked rakishly up at her, but it wasn't rolled back in her head. Kate acted slowly and precisely. She picked up the handkerchief and smelled it. Some of the ammonia had evaporated, but the smell was still sharp. She laid the cloth lightly over Faye's face, and when Faye twisted and turned and came near to waking, Kate took the handkerchief away and let Faye sink back. This she did three times. She put the handkerchief away and picked up an ivory crochet hook from the marble top of the bureau. She turned down the cover and pressed the blunt end of the ivory against Faye's flabby breast with a steady, increasing pressure until the sleeping woman whined and writhed. Then Kate explored the sensitive places of the body with the hook, under the arm, the groin, the ear, the clitoris, and always she removed the pressure just before Faye awakened fully. Faye was very near the surface now. She whined and sniffled and tossed. Kate stroked her forehead and ran smooth fingers over her inner arm and spoke softly to her.
"Dear, dear, you're having such a bad dream. Come out of the bad dream, Mother."
Faye's breathing grew more regular. She heaved a great sigh and turned on her side and settled down with little grunts of comfort. Kate stood up from the bed, and a wave of dizziness rose in her head. She steadied herself, then went to the door and listened, slipped out, and moved cautiously to her own room. She undressed quickly and put on her nightgown and a robe and slippers. She brushed her hair and put it up and covered it with a sleeping cap, and she sponged her face with Florida water. She went quietly back to Faye's room. Faye was still sleeping peacefully on her side. Kate opened the door to the hall. She carried the glass of water to the bed and poured cold water in Faye's ear. Faye screamed and screamed again. Ethel's frightened face looked out of her room in time to see Kate in robe and slippers at Faye's door. The cook was right behind Kate, and he put out his hand to stop her.
"Now don't go in there, Miss Kate. You don't know what's in there."
"Nonsense. Faye's in trouble."
Kate burst in and ran to the bed. Faye's eyes were wild, and she was crying and moaning.
"What is it? What is it, dear?"
The cook was in the middle of the room, and three sleep-haggard girls stood in the doorway.
"Tell me, what is it?" Kate cried. "Oh, darling, the dreams, the dreams. I can't stand them."
Kate turned to the door.
"She's had a nightmare. She'll be all right. You go back to bed. I'll stay with her a while. Alex, bring a pot of tea."
Kate was tireless. The other girls remarked on it. She put cold towels on Faye's aching head and held her shoulders and the cup of tea for her. She petted and babied her, but the look of horror wouldn't go out of Faye's eyes. At 10 o'clock, Alex brought in a can of beer and without a word put it on the bureau top. Kate held a glass of it to Faye's lips.
"It'll help, darling. Drink it down." "I never want another drink."
"Nonsense. Drink it down like medicine. That's a good girl. Now just lie back and go to sleep."
"I'm afraid to sleep."
"Were the dreams so bad?"
"Horrible. Horrible."
"Tell me about them, Mother.
Maybe that will help.
Faye shrank back.
I wouldn't tell anyone. How could I have dreamed them? They weren't like my dreams.
Poor little mother. I love you, Kate said. You go to sleep. I'll keep the dreams away. Gradually, Faye did slip off to sleep. Kate sat beside the bed, studying her.
Chapter 21. In human affairs of danger and delicacy, successful conclusion is sharply limited by hurry. So often men trip by being in a rush. If one were properly to perform a difficult and subtle act, he should first inspect the end to be achieved, and then, once he had accepted the end as desirable, he should forget it completely and concentrate solely on the means. By this method, he would not be moved to false action by anxiety or hurry or fear. Very few people learn this. What made Kate so effective was that she had either learned it or been born with the knowledge. Kate never hurried. If a barrier arose, she waited until it had disappeared before continuing. She was capable of complete relaxation between the times for action. Also, she was mistress of a technique which is the basis of good wrestling, that of letting your opponent do the heavy work toward his own defeat, or of guiding his strength toward his weaknesses. Kate was in no hurry. She thought to the end very quickly and then put it out of her mind. She set herself to work on method. She built a structure and attacked it, and if it showed the slightest shakiness, she tore it down and started fresh. This she did only late at night, or otherwise when she was completely alone, so that no change or preoccupation was noticeable in her manner. Her building was constructed of personalities, materials, knowledge, and time. She had access to the first and last. She set about getting knowledge and materials. But while she did, she set in motion a series of imperceptible springs and pendulums, and left them to pick up their own momenta. First, the cook told about the will. It must have been the cook. He thought he did anyway. Kate heard about it from Ethel, and she confronted him in the kitchen, where he was kneading bread, his hairy big arms flour to the elbows, and his hands yeast-bleached. "Do you think it was a good thing to tell about being a witness?" she said mildly. "What do you think Miss Fay is going to think?" He looked confused. "But I didn't."
"You didn't what? Tell about it, or think it would hurt?"
"I don't think I..."
"You don't think you told? Only 3 people knew. Do you think I told? Or do you think Miss Fay did?"
She saw the puzzled look come into his eyes and knew that by now he was far from sure that he had not told. In a moment he would be sure that he had. 3 of the girls questioned Kate about the will, coming to her together for mutual strength. Kate said,
"I don't think Fay would like me to discuss it. Alex should have kept his mouth shut."
Their wills wavered, and she said,
"Why don't you ask Fay?"
"Oh, we wouldn't do that."
"But you dare to talk behind her back. Come on now. Let's go into her, and you can ask her the questions."
"No, Kate, no."
"Well, I'll have to tell her you asked. Wouldn't you rather be there? Don't you think she would feel better if she knew you weren't talking behind her back?"
"Well,
I know I would. I always like a person who comes right out."
Quietly, she surrounded and nudged and pushed until they stood in Faye's room. Kate said,
"They asked me about a certain you-know-what. Alex admits he let it out."
Faye was slightly puzzled.
"Well, dear, I can't see that it's such a secret."
Kate said,
"Oh, I'm glad you feel that way. But you see that I couldn't mention it until you did."
"You think it's bad to tell, Kate?"
"Oh, not at all. I'm glad. But it seemed to me that it wouldn't be loyal of me to mention it before you did."
You're sweet, Kate. I don't see any harm. You see, girls, I'm alone in the world, and I have taken Kate as my daughter. She takes such care of me. Get the box, Kate.
And each girl took the will in her own hands and inspected it. It was so simple they could repeat it word for word to the other girls. They watched Kate to see how she would change, perhaps become a tyrant, but if anything, she was nicer to them. A week later, when Kate became ill, she went right on with her supervision of the house, and no one would have known if she hadn't been found standing rigid in the hall with agony printed on her face. She begged the girls not to tell Fay, but they were outraged, and it was Fay who forced her to bed and called Dr. Wilde. He was a nice man and a pretty good doctor. He looked at her tongue, felt her pulse, asked her a few intimate questions, and then tapped his lower lip. "Right here," he asked, and exerted a little pressure on the small of her back. "No? Here? Does this hurt? So, well, I think you just need a kidney flushing." He left yellow, green, and red pills to be taken in sequence. The pills did good work. She did have one little flare-up. She told Fay, "I'll go to the doctor's office." "I'll ask him to come here." "To bring me some more pills? Nonsense. I'll go in the morning."
This ends Disc 9. East of Eden, Disc 10.
Dr. Wilde was a good man and an honest man. He was accustomed to say of his profession that all he was sure of was that sulfur would cure the itch. He wasn't casual about his practice. Like so many country doctors, he was a combination doctor, priest, psychiatrist to his town. He knew most of the secrets, weaknesses, and the braveries of Salinas. He never learned to take death easily. Indeed, the death of a patient always gave him a sense of failure and hopeless ignorance. He wasn't a bold man, and he used surgery only as a last and fearful resort. The drugstore was coming in to help doctors, but Dr. Wilde was one of the few to maintain his own dispensary and to compound his own prescriptions. Many years of overwork and interrupted sleep had made him a little vague and preoccupied. At 8:30 on a Wednesday morning, Kate walked up Main Street, climbed the stairs of the Monterey County Bank Building, and walked along the corridor until she found the door which said, "Dr. Wilde, office hours 11 to 2. At 9:30, Dr. Wilde put his buggy in the livery stable and wearily lifted out his black bag. He had been out in the Alisal, presiding at the disintegration of old Lady German. She had not been able to terminate her life neatly. There were codicils. Even now, Dr. Wilde wondered whether the tough, dry, stringy life was completely gone out of her. She was 97, and a death certificate meant nothing to her. Why, she had corrected the priest who prepared her. The mystery of death was on him. It often was. Yesterday, Alan Day, 37, 6 feet 1 inch, strong as a bull and valuable to 400 acres and a large family, had meekly surrendered his life to pneumonia after a little exposure and 3 days of fever. Dr. Wilde knew it was a mystery. His eyelids felt grainy. He thought he would take a sponge bath and have a drink before his first office patients arrived with their stomach aches. He climbed the stairs and put his worn key in the lock of his office door. The key wouldn't turn. He set his bag on the floor and exerted pressure. The key refused to budge. He grabbed the doorknob and pulled outward and rattled the key. The door was open from within. Kate stood in front of him.
"Oh, good morning. Lock was stuck. How'd you get in?"
"It wasn't locked. I was early and came in to wait."
"Wasn't locked?"
He turned the key the other way and saw that, sure enough, the little bar slipped out easily.
"I'm getting old, I guess," he said. "I'm forgetful." He sighed. "I don't know why I lock it anyway. You could get in with a piece of baling wire. And who'd want to get in anyway?"
He seemed to see her for the first time.
I don't have office hours till 11.
Kate said, I needed some more of those pills, and I couldn't come later.
Pills? Oh, yes, you're the girl from down at Fay's.
That's right.
Feeling better?
Yes, the pills help.
Well, it can't hurt, he said. Did I leave the door to the dispensary open, too?
What's a dispensary?
Over there, that door.
I guess you must have.
Getting old. How is Fay?
Well, I'm worried about her. She was real sick a while ago, had cramps, and went a little out of her head.
She's had a stomach disorder before, Dr. Wilde said. You can't live like that and eat at all hours and be very well. I can't, anyway. We just call it stomach trouble. Comes from eating too much and staying up all night. Now, the pills, do you remember what color?
There were three kinds, yellow, red, and green.
Oh, yes, yes, I remember. While he poured pills into a round cardboard box, she stood in the door.
What a lot of medicines,
Dr. Wilde said. Yes, and the older I get, the fewer I use. I got some of those when I started to practice. Never used them. That's a beginner's stock. I was going to experiment. Alchemy.
What?
Nothing. Here you are. Tell Fay to get some sleep and eat some vegetables. I've been up all night. Let yourself out, will you?
He went wavering back into the surgery. Kate glanced after him, and then her eyes flicked over the lines of bottles and containers. She closed the dispensary door and looked around the outer office. One book in the case was out of line. She pushed it back until it was shoulder to shoulder with its brothers. She picked up her big handbag from the leather sofa and left. In her own room, Kate took 5 small bottles and a strip of scribbled paper from her handbag. She put the whole works in the toe of a stocking, pushed the wad into a rubber overshoe, and stood it with its fellow in the back of her closet. During the following months, a gradual change came over Fay's house. The girls were sloppy and touchy. If they'd been told to clean themselves and their rooms, a deep resentment would have set in, and the house would have reeked of ill temper. But it didn't work that way. Kate sat at table one evening that she had just happened to look in Ethel's room, and it was so neat and pretty she couldn't help buying her a present. When Ethel unwrapped the package right at the table, it was a big bottle of Hoyt's German, enough to keep her smelling sweet for a long time. Ethel was pleased, and she hoped Kate hadn't seen the dirty clothes under the bed. After supper, she not only got the clothes out, but brushed the floors and swept the cobwebs out of the corners. Then Grace looked so pretty one afternoon that Kate couldn't help giving her the rhinestone butterfly pin she was wearing, and Grace had to rush up and put on a clean shirtwaist to set it off. Alex in the kitchen, who, if he had believed what was usually said of him, would have considered himself a murderer, found that he had a magic hand with biscuits. He discovered that cooking was something you couldn't learn. You had to feel it. Cotton Eye learned that nobody hated him. His tub-thumping piano playing changed imperceptibly. He told Kate, "It's funny what you remember when you think back." "Like what?" she asked.
"Well, like this."
And he played for her.
"That's lovely," she said. "What is it?"
"Well, I don't know. I think it's Chopin. If I could just see the music."
He told her how he had lost his sight, and he had never told anyone else. It was a bad story. That Saturday night, he took the chain off the piano strings and played something he had been remembering and practicing in the morning, something called Moonlight, a piece by Beethoven, Cotton Eye thought. Ethel said it sounded like Moonlight, and did he know the words?
"He don't have words," said Cotton Eye.
Oscar Tripp, up from Gonzales for Saturday night, said,
"Well, it ought to have. It's pretty."
One night there were presents for everyone, because Fay's was the best house, the cleanest and nicest in the whole county. And who was responsible for that? Why, the girls. Who else? And did they ever taste seasoning like in that stew?
Alex retired into the kitchen and shyly wiped his eyes with the back of his wrist. He bet that he could make a plum pudding that would knock their eyes out. Georgia was getting up at 10 every morning and taking piano lessons from Cotton Eye, and her nails were clean. Coming back from 11 o'clock mass on a Sunday morning, Grace said to Trixie, "And I was about ready to get married and give up whoring. Can you imagine?" "It's sure nice," said Trixie. "Jenny's girls came over for Faye's birthday cake, and they couldn't believe their eyes. They don't talk about nothing else but how it is at Faye's. Jenny's sore." "Did you see the score on the blackboard this morning?" "Sure I did. 87 tricks in 1 week. Let Jenny or the nigger match that when there ain't no holidays." "No holidays? Hell, have you forgot it's Lent? They ain't turning a trick at Jenny's." After her illness and her evil dreams, Faye was quiet and depressed. Kate knew she was being watched, but there was no help for that. And she had made sure the rolled paper was still in the box and all the girls had seen it or heard about it. One afternoon, Faye looked up from her solitaire game as Kate knocked and entered the room. "How do you feel, Mother?"
"Fine, just fine."
Her eyes were secretive. Faye wasn't very clever.
"You know, Kate, I'd like to go to Europe."
"Well, how wonderful. And you deserve it, and you can afford it."
"I don't want to go alone. I want you to go with me."
Kate looked at her in astonishment.
"Me? You want to take me?"
"Sure, why not?"
"Oh, you sweet dear. When can we go?"
"You want to?"
"I've always dreamed of it. When can we go? Let's go soon."
Faye's eyes lost their suspicion, and her face relaxed.
"Maybe next summer," she said. "We can plan it for next summer." "Kate?"
"Yes, Mother?"
You don't turn any tricks anymore, do you?"
"Why should I? You take such good care of me."
Faye slowly gathered up the cards and tapped them square and dropped them in the table drawer. Kate pulled up a chair.
"I want to ask your advice about something."
"What is it?"
"Well, you know, I'm trying to help you."
"You're doing everything, darling.
You know, our biggest expense is food, and it gets bigger in the winter."
"Yes?"
"Well, right now you can buy fruit and all kinds of vegetables for 2 bits a lug. And in the winter, you know what we pay for canned peaches and canned string beans."
"You aren't planning to start preserving."
"Well, why shouldn't we?"
"What will Alex say to that?"
"Mother, you can believe it or not, or you can ask him. Alex suggested it."
"No."
"Well, he did. Cross my heart."
"Well, I'll be damned."
"Oh, I'm sorry, sweet. It slipped out."
The kitchen turned into a cannery, and all the girls helped. Alex truly believed it was his idea. At the end of the season, he had a silver watch with his name engraved on the back to prove it. Ordinarily, both Faye and Kate had their supper at the long table in the dining room. But on Sunday nights when Alex was off and the girls dined on thick sandwiches, Kate served supper for two in Faye's room. It was a pleasant and a ladylike time. There was always some little delicacy, very special and good, foie gras or a tossed salad. Pastry bought at Lang's Bakery just across Main Street. And instead of the white oilcloth and paper napkins of the dining room, Faye's table was covered with a white damask cloth, and the napkins were linen. It had a party feeling, too, candles and, something rare in Selena's, a bowl of flowers. Kate could make pretty floral arrangements using only the blossoms from weeds she picked up in the fields.
"What a clever girl she is," Faye would say. "She can do anything, and she can make do with anything. We're going to Europe. And did you know Kate speaks French? Well, she can. When you get her alone, ask her to say something in French. She's teaching me. Know how you say bread in French?"
Faye was having a wonderful time.
Kate gave her excitement and perpetual planning. On Saturday, the 14th of October, the first wild ducks went over Salinas. Faye saw them from her window, a great wedge flying south. When Kate came in before supper, as she always did, Faye told her about it. "I guess the winter's nearly here," she said. "We'll have to get Alex to set up the stoves." "Ready for your tonic, Mother dear?"
"Yes, I am. You're making me lazy waiting on me."
"I like to wait on you," said Kate. She took the bottle of Lydia Pinkham's vegetable compound from the drawer and held it up to the light. "Not much left," she said. "We'll have to get some more." "Oh, I think I have 3 bottles left of the dozen in my closet." Kate picked up the glass. "There's a fly in the glass," she said. "I'll just go and wash it out." In the kitchen, she rinsed the glass. From her pocket, she took the eyedropper. The end was closed with a little piece of potato, the way you plug the spout of a kerosene can. She carefully squeezed a few drops of clear liquid into the glass, a tincture of Nux Vomica. Back in Faye's room, she poured the 3 tablespoons of vegetable compound in the glass and stirred it. Faye drank her tonic and licked her lips. "It tastes bitter," she said. "Does it, dear? Let me taste." Kate took a spoonful from the bottle and made a face. "So it does," she said. "I guess it's been standing around too long. I'm going to throw it out. See, that is bitter. Let me get you a glass of water." At supper, Faye's face was flushed. She stopped eating and seemed to be listening. "What's the matter?" Kate asked. "Mother, what's the matter?" Faye seemed to tear her attention away.
"Why, I don't know. I guess a little heart flutter. Just all of a sudden I felt afraid, and my heart got to pounding."
"Don't you want me to help you to your room?"
"No, dear, I feel all right now."
Grace put down her fork.
"Well, you got a real high flash, Faye."
Kate said, "I don't like it. I wish you'd see Dr. Wilde."
"No, it's all right now."
"You frightened me," said Kate. "Have you ever had it before?"
"Well, I'm a little short of breath sometimes. I guess I'm getting too stout."
Faye didn't feel very good that Saturday night, and about 10 o'clock Kate persuaded her to go to bed. Kate looked in several times until she was sure Faye was asleep. The next day, Faye felt all right.
"I guess I'm just short-winded," she said.
"Well, we're going to have invalid food for my darling," said Kate. "I've made some chicken soup for you. And we'll have a string bean salad the way you like it, just oil and vinegar, and a cup of tea."
"Honest to God, Kate, I feel pretty good."
"It wouldn't hurt either of us to eat a little light. You frightened me last night. I had an aunt who died of heart trouble, and that leaves a memory, you know."
"I never had any trouble with my heart, just a little short-winded when I climbed the stairs."
In the kitchen, Kate set the supper on 2 trays. She measured out the French dressing in a cup and poured it on the string bean salad. On Faye's tray, she put her favorite cup and set the soup forward on the stove to heat. Finally, she took the eyedropper from her left pocket and squeezed 2 drops of croton oil on the string beans and stirred it in. She went to her room and swallowed the contents of a small bottle of Cascara Sagrada and hurried back to the kitchen. She poured the hot soup in the cups, filled the teapot with boiling water, and carried the trays to Faye's room.
"I didn't think I was hungry," Faye said, "but that soup smells good."
"I made a special salad dressing for you," said Kate. "It's an old recipe, rosemary and thyme. See if you like it."
"Why, it's delicious," said Faye.
"Is there anything you can't do, darling?" Kate was stricken first. Her forehead beaded with perspiration, and she doubled over, crying with pain. Her eyes were staring, and the saliva ran from her mouth. Faye ran to the hallway, screaming for help. The girls and a few Sunday customers crowded into the room. Kate was writhing on the floor. 2 of the regulars lifted her onto Faye's bed and tried to straighten her out, but she screamed and doubled up again. The sweat poured from her body and wet her clothes.
Faye was wiping Kate's forehead with a towel when the pain struck her. It was about an hour before Dr. Wilde could be found playing euchre with a friend. He was dragged down to the line by two hysterical whores. Faye and Kate were weak from vomiting and diarrhea, and the spasms continued at intervals. Dr. Wilde said, "What did you eat?" And then he noticed the trays. "Are these string beans home canned?" he demanded. "Sure," said Grace. "We did them right here." "Did any of you have them?" "Well, no, you see. Go out and break every jar," Dr. Wilde said. "God damn the string beans." And he unpacked his stomach pump. On Tuesday, he sat with the two pale, weak women. Kate's bed had been moved into Faye's room. "I can tell you now," he said. "I didn't think you had a chance. You're pretty lucky. And let homemade string beans alone. Buy canned ones." "What is it?" Kate asked. "Botulism. I don't know much about it, but damn few ever get over it. I guess it's because you're young and she's tough." He asked Faye, "Are you still bleeding from the bowels?"
"Yes, a little."
"Well, here are some morphine pills. They'll bind you up. You probably ruptured something. But they say you can't kill a whore. Now take it easy, both of you." That was October 17th. Faye was never really well again. She would make a little gain and then go to pieces. She had a bad time on December 3rd, and it took even longer for her to gain her strength. February 12th, the bleeding became violent, and the strain seemed to have weakened Faye's heart. Dr. Wilde listened a long time through his stethoscope. Kate was haggard, and her slender body had shrunk to bones. The girls tried to spell her with Faye, but Kate would not leave. Grace said, "God knows when's the last sleep she had. If Faye was to die, I think it would kill that girl." "She's just as like to blow her brains out," said Ethel. Dr. Wilde took Kate into the day-darkened parlor and put his black bag on the chair. "I might as well tell you," he said. "Her heart just can't take the strain, I'm afraid. She's all torn up inside. That goddamn botulism, worse than a rattlesnake." He looked away from Kate's haggard face. "I thought it would be better to tell you so you can prepare yourself," he said lamely, and put his hand on her bony shoulder. "Not many people have such loyalty. Give her a little warm milk if she can take it." Kate carried a basin of warm water to the table beside the bed. When Trixie looked in, Kate was bathing Faye and using the fine linen napkins to do it. Then she brushed the lank blonde hair and braided it. Faye's skin had shrunk, clinging to jaw and skull, and her eyes were huge and vacant. She tried to speak, and Kate said, "Shh, save your strength, save your strength." She went to the kitchen for a glass of warm milk and put it on the bedside table. She took two little bottles from her pocket and sucked a little from each one into the eyedropper.
"Open up, Mother. This is a new kind of medicine. Now be brave, dear. This will taste bad."
She squeezed the fluid far back on Faye's tongue and held up her head so she could drink a little milk to take away the taste.
"Now you rest, and I'll be back in a little while."
Kate slipped quietly out of the room. The kitchen was dark. She opened the outer door and crept out and moved back among the weeds. The ground was damp from the spring rains. At the back of the lot, she dug a small hole with a pointed stick. She dropped in a number of small, thin bottles and an eyedropper. With the stick, she crushed the glass to bits and scraped dirt over them. Rain was beginning to fall as Kate went back to the house. At first, they had to tie Kate down to keep her from hurting herself. From violence, she went into a gloomy stupor. It was a long time before she regained her health. And she forgot completely about the will. It was Trixie who finally remembered. Chapter 22. On the Trask place, Adam drew into himself. The unfinished Sanchez house lay open to the wind and rain, and the new floorboards buckled and warped with moisture. The laid-out vegetable gardens rioted with weeds. Adam seemed clothed in a viscosity that slowed his movements and held his thoughts down. He saw the world through gray water. Now and then his mind fought its way upward, and when the light broke in, it brought him only a sickness of mind, and he retired into the grayness again. He was aware of the twins because he heard them cry and laugh, but he felt only a thin distaste for them. To Adam, they were symbols of his loss. His neighbors drove up into his little valley, and every one of them would have understood anger or sorrow and so helped him. But they could do nothing with the cloud that hung over him. Adam didn't resist them. He simply didn't see them. And before long, the neighbors stopped driving up the road under the oaks. For a time, Lee tried to stimulate Adam to awareness, but Lee was a busy man. He cooked and washed. He bathed the twins and fed them. Through his hard and constant work, he grew fond of the two little boys. He talked to them in Cantonese, and Chinese words were the first they recognized and tried to repeat. Samuel Hamilton went back twice to try to wedge Adam up and out of his shock. Then Liza stepped in. "I want you to stay away from there," she said. "You come back a changed man. Samuel, you don't change him. He changes you. I can see the look of him in your face. Have you thought of the two little boys, Liza?" he asked. "I've thought of your own family," she said snappishly. "You lay a crepe on us for days after." "All right, Mother," he said. But it saddened him because Samuel could not mind his own business when there was pain in any man. It was no easy thing for him to abandon Adam to his desolation. Adam had paid him for his work, had even paid him for the windmill parts, and did not want the windmills. Samuel sold the equipment and sent Adam the money. He had no answer. He became aware of an anger at Adam Trask. It seemed to Samuel that Adam might be pleasuring himself with sadness. But there was little leisure to brood. Joe was off to college, to that school Leland Stanford had built on his farm near Palo Alto. Tom worried his father, for Tom grew deeper and deeper into books. He did his work well enough, but Samuel felt that Tom had not joy enough. Will and George were doing well in business, and Joe was writing letters home in rhymed verse and making as smart an attack on all the accepted verities as was helpful. Samuel wrote to Joe saying, "I would be disappointed if you had not become an atheist, and I read pleasantly that you have, in your age and wisdom, accepted agnosticism, the way you'd take a cookie on a full stomach. But I would ask you with all my understanding heart not to try to convert your mother. Your last letter only made her think you are not well. Your mother doesn't believe there are many ills incurable by good, strong soup. She put your brave attack on the structure of our civilization down to a stomach ache. It worries her. Her faith is a mountain, and you, my son, haven't even got a shovel yet." Liza was getting old. Samuel saw it in her face, and he could not feel old himself, white beard or no. But Liza was living backwards, and that's the proof. There was a time when she looked on his plans and prophecies as the crazy shoutings of a child. Now she felt that they were unseemly in a grown man. They three, Liza, Tom, and Samuel, were alone on the ranch. Una was married to a stranger and gone away. Desi had her dressmaking business in Salinas. Olive had married her young man, and Molly was married and living, believe it or not, in an apartment in San Francisco. There was perfume and a white bearskin rug in the bedroom in front of the fireplace, and Molly smoked a gold-tipped cigarette, Violet Milo, with her coffee after dinner. One day Samuel strained his back lifting a bale of hay,
and it hurt his feelings more than his back, for he couldn't imagine a life in which Sam Hamilton was not privileged to lift a bale of hay. He felt insulted by his back, almost as he would have been if one of his children had been dishonest. In King City, Dr. Tilson felt him over. The doctor grew more testy with his overworked years.
"You sprained your back."
"That I did," said Samuel. "And you drove all the way in to have me tell you that you'd sprained your back and charge you $2.
"Here's your $2.
"And you want to know what to do about it?"
"Sure I do."
"Don't sprain it anymore. Now take your money back. You're not a fool, Samuel, unless you're getting childish."
"But it hurts."
"Of course it hurts. How would you know it was strained if it didn't?" Samuel laughed.
"You're good for me," he said. "You're more than $2 good for me. Keep the money."
The doctor looked closely at him.
"I think you're telling the truth, Samuel. I'll keep the money."
Samuel went in to see Will in his fine new store. He hardly knew his son, for Will was getting fat and prosperous, and he wore a coat and vest and a gold ring on his little finger.
"I've got a package made up for Mother," Will said. "Some little cans of things from France. Mushrooms and liver paste and sardines so little you can hardly see them."
"She'll just send them to Joe," said Samuel.
"Can't you make her eat them?"
"No," said his father, "but she'll enjoy sending them to Joe." Lee came into the store and his eyes lighted up.
"How do, missy?" he said.
"Hello, Lee. How are the boys?"
"The boy's fine."
Samuel said, "I'm going to have a glass of beer next door, Lee. Be glad to have you join me." Lee and Samuel sat at the little round table in the bar room, and Samuel drew figures on the scrubbed wood with the moisture of his beer glass.
"I wanted to go see you and Adam, but I didn't think I could do any good."
"Well, you can't do any harm. I thought he'd get over it, but he still walks around like a ghost."
"It's over a year, isn't it?" Samuel asked.
3 months over."
"Well, what do you think I can do?"
"I don't know," said Lee. "Maybe you could shock him out of it. Nothing else has worked."
"I'm not good at shocking. I'd probably end up by shocking myself. By the way, what did he name the twins?"
"They don't have any names."
"You're making a joke, Lee."
"I'm not making jokes."
"What does he call them?"
"He calls them they."
"I mean when he speaks to them."
"When he speaks to them, he calls them you. One or both."
"This is nonsense," Samuel said angrily. "What kind of fool is the man?"
"I've meant to come and tell you. He's a dead man unless you can wake him up."
Samuel said,
"I'll come. I'll bring a horsewhip."
"No names."
"You're damn right I'll come, Lee."
"When?"
"Tomorrow."
"I'll kill a chicken," said Lee.
"You'll like the twins, Mr. Hamilton. They're fine-looking boys. I won't tell Mr. Trask you're coming."
Shyly, Samuel told his wife he wanted to visit the Trask place. He thought she would pile up strong walls of objection, and for one of the few times in his life, he would disobey her wish, no matter how strong her objection. It gave him a sad feeling in the stomach to think of disobeying his wife. He explained his purpose almost as though he were confessing. Liza put her hands on her hips during the telling, and his heart sank. When he was finished, she continued to look at him, he thought, coldly. Finally, she said,
"Samuel, do you think you can move this rock of a man?"
"Why, I don't know, Mother."
He hadn't expected this.
"I don't know."
"Do you think it is such an important matter that those babies have names right now?"
"Well, it seems so to me," he said lamely.
"Samuel, do you think why you want to go? Is it your natural, incurable nosiness? Is it your black inability to mind your own business?"
"Now, Liza, I know my feelings pretty well. I thought it might be more than that."
"It had better be more than that," she said.
This man is not admitted.